I guess one of the obvious questions I should ask you, William Styron, is have you seen the movie Sophie's Choice yet?
Yeah, I did see it. And I saw a very rough version without with some of the, or a great deal of the soundtrack missing, and some of the photography done in very imperfect black and white. But it's quite a good movie. It's a very fine movie, I think.
When do you expect to see the finished product?
On the night of the world premiere, which is December 5th, being given benefit for Amnesty International at Cinema 1 and 2 here in New York. And I guess that'll be the first time I get to see the whole thing.
That's, I believe, a Monday, isn't it? Monday.
It's Sunday.
A Sunday.
Sunday night, yeah.
Because I had been asked to attend the screening, and I think that was on a Monday.
Yeah, there's going to be a screening afterwards. This is the world premiere. It's already sold out, oversold by several hundred, or even 1,000 tickets, I think. Everybody wanted to go to it.
What role did you have in the making of that motion picture?
Almost nothing, except giving them the body of myself to work on. I did have the, I think, a fortune or advantage of having Alan Pakula, the director, show me the script. He wanted me to see and at least give informal approval to the script, which I did, and it was a good script because it adhered very much to the spirit of the book. And I think the movie itself is very faithful to the book, although I really, to answer your question more directly, I've had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Were you worried as to what they might have done to the motion picture?
I was, yeah. I thought it could have been a terrible botch. It could have been overly melodramatic, or it could have been trivialized. But by and large, though, I find there are some things I don't particularly like about it. I think that's inevitable. Because it would have had to be a 9-hour movie to encompass a 600-page book. But by and large, I think it's a very, very creditable translation from novel to film.
Would you have wanted to do the script on it? I noticed that Norman Mailer wrote the screenplay for the TV version of Executioner's Song.
No, I made that decision very early on, as I've done with all my books. I've never wanted to deal with it. It's really, one gets stale enough writing the work itself, and to have to go over the old ground again, it seems to me just really more than one can tolerate.
I think a lot of people are waiting for the movie because Sophie's Choice is a novel of ideas, and it would seem to me that that would be... There's action in Sophie's Choice, too, obviously, but mm-hmm. It would seem to me that the novel as a whole is a rather difficult one to translate to the screen.
Well, it's it's a very complex book in the sense that it moves through 5 or 6 frames of time. It deals with abstractions, as you just implied, with Auschwitz as a concept, with the Holocaust as a concept, and these are things that are very difficult for a film to deal with. One can say, even eloquently, perhaps on page. A great deal about the Holocaust, let's say, as a philosophical concept, but how are you going to do that in a film? You can't. And so there are large areas of the book which are simply missing in the film, but I didn't expect anything different.
Well, let's go on to your new book of essays, This Quiet Dust, and I'd like to ask you a couple of things about that. In This Quiet Dust, you show your concern about the issue of capital punishment. I would presume that you are still strongly against that.
Yes, I am. I'm not a zealot. As I said in the book somewhere, I think there are more important issues in society today. But I do think it's also a blot on the system that we have capital punishment, especially when so many, or practically all the nations of the earth, civilized nations, have abolished it, all free nations. Last one to abolish it was France under Mitterrand. And here we are, the United States still legalizing murder.
Well, you say there are other more pressing issues, but what is more pressing than a moral issue with regard to life and death?
Yeah. No, I didn't mean to minimize it. All I mean is to say that as hateful as I find it, I don't find it as hateful as say, the Reagan's arms race. That's all I mean. I mean, I would address my energies to that before I would to capital punishment, though I'm dead set against the death penalty.
In This Quiet Dust, you almost took to your home a convicted killer in Connecticut who was spared the death penalty and about to be released. Can you just fill us in what happened in that case?
Well, he was a young black man who had murdered a woman in a premeditated way up in Hartford, and had been sentenced to the electric chair. And I wrote an article in Esquire to espousing his cause, and it was instrumental in having his sentence commuted.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know my terminology. Commuted to life imprisonment. In the years that followed, while he was serving part of his life term, it turned out that he was not the complete mental defective that we had all thought he was. In fact, he was a very promising young man, and he looked good. He looked ripe for parole. His record in jail was terrific, and when I say we, I mean myself and other interested parties, including some students at Trinity College, including, again, I might add, George Will, who is the Newsweek columnist, who was then a graduate student at Trinity. At any rate, we arranged to have his sentence, or we pushed to have his sentence reduced to 7 years with parole. That came about, and we were all ready to greet him and to welcome him back into society. He was going to come to my house as sort of halfway house before going to Trinity as a special student, and 2 days before his release at Summers Prison, he escaped. And he wandered over into Massachusetts, picked up a woman and some children, kidnapped them, raped the woman, and was caught, and of course sentenced to a long term in Massachusetts, which he has just finished. He served another 11 years, and now he's back in Connecticut serving time for escape.
How did this make you feel, knowing that you were about to open your home to this?
It made me feel very nervous. I was crushed when this thing happened. In the same way, as I point out in this book of essays, in the same way I think Norman Mailer was crushed in a much more dramatic way, his protege Jack Henry Abbott stabbed to death a young man here in New York. And Mailer, really, I've talked to him about it, has suffered the same kind of anguish over this that I did.
Well, he has been excoriated, actually, for coming to the defense of Abbott so strongly in the trial and everything. What do you think? Do you think Mailer should have done it, or do you think he should have just stayed in the background and kept his mouth shut? Or?
No, I think Mailer had every... I disagree with Mailer in many respects about a lot of things, but I think in this case, his support of Abbott in the very beginning was reasonable. As I pointed out in this essay, every day criminals are let loose into society by the dozens, and they go and sin no more. These were terrible errors committed, I suppose, but they were honest errors. And to suddenly clamp the lid on the possibility of redemption and freedom, even for, I should say, especially killers, is, I think, a very sorry precedent. Murderers have the best a non-crime rate of anyone released from prison.
Would you advocate ever releasing Jack Henry Abbott to society?
Certainly not any longer. No, I certainly wouldn't. I think Abbott, it was clearly demonstrated that Abbott was a dangerous, a psychopathic personality. And in retrospect, plainly he should not have been released. But as I'm repeating myself, it was an honest mistake on Mailer's part. and an honest mistake, I think, on my part and my friends, when we worked for Ben Reed's release in Connecticut.
You're not looking for another martyr in the behind prison walls now, are you?
No, I'm certainly not. And however, it does not diminish my ultimate faith in Reed. He's going to serve his 2 years in Connecticut for escape, and then he's going to have to be released. And I'm going to do what I can to make his entry into society after something like 28 years in prison a good entry.
Are you going to open your house to him?
I might, yes. I'm not sure, but it depends on. He's now in a maximum security prison in Connecticut, where the conditions are horrible. He's back in the jungle. I just hope he survives these last 2 years. He's now a man in his mid-40s. I think men of this age, I might add, who are not psychopathic, are very safe. They're a good risk.
You and Robert Lowell were ardent supporters of Gene McCarthy when he ran for the presidency in 1968. Well, I guess that made you a political activist at that time. Would you say that you are still a political activist?
Not really. No, I'm a peripheral political enthusiast, I think you could say. I worked very hard, for instance, for the election of Toby Moffat in Connecticut against Lowell Weicker. We all lost. He didn't make it, alas. That sort of thing I still indulge in, but I'm not an activist, really. I suppose if a crisis happened again, like the war in Vietnam, I would be more of an activist, but at the moment I'm not.
Somehow I see you as potentially being a supporter of a maverick like Weicker, a liberal.
Oh, yeah, and that was a very unfortunate campaign in the sense that Weicker, it's too bad, for instance, that Toby Moffat wasn't running against someone like Jesse Helms. But he wasn't. He was running against, when all the chips are down, a good man. And it was a sad situation.
Well, you know, Lowell turned down an opportunity to speak at the White House during the Johnson White House during a conference on the arts. What would you do if you were invited to the Reagan White House tomorrow?
I was already invited, and I turned it down, the invitation down.
What was the invitation for?
Some rather dull dinner for the president of Venezuela or something like that.
Did you do it out of political motivation?
Or yeah, I don't want to endorse a man whom I think is a, to my mind, an irresponsible president. So therefore, I didn't go, and I wouldn't go.
Have you obviously made reference to it a moment ago. You've been monitoring the discussion about the nuclear warheads and the MX missiles and all of this. What are your thoughts?
Well, I just hope that this maniac plan of putting all those missiles in southeastern Wyoming is beaten in the Congress. I think there's a good chance it will be. I think it's horrible. $40 billion for that, I just think it's a tragedy. But I think there is a chance it will be beaten.
In your tribute to James Jones, which is in This Quiet Dust, you make a stinging attack on the book critics. I think you made a reference to second-rate book hacks from Kansas City. Some of the critics haven't been as kind as they might have been to This Quiet Dust.
Yeah.
And do you still take this adversary relationship toward the critics?
No, I think that that critics have a job and they do it. I find that that you can't do anything about critics. I was interested. I had lunch today with my editor at Random House, who's a longtime friend, and we were discussing something that we both realized was true, that in the 22 years of our relationship at Random House and the books that I published, I have yet to receive a favorable review from the New York Times. That's 4 or 5 books. It was an interesting idea that for better or for worse, I've had negative reviews from the Times, including the last one from an English professor about This Quiet Dust. What can you say? I don't think it's a conspiracy, but it is I'm not paranoid about it. But it is odd that in this 2 decades and more, I should receive entirely negative reviews from this monolithic organ of our culture.
You know, I was reading this massive biography of Robert Lowell recently. You knew Lowell, and Lowell would be highly critical of his fellow poets, and indeed they exchanged correspondence critiquing each other's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
They were very hard on each other, but I think they accepted the criticism as a matter of course. It did not take it personally. Do you find that to be the case yourself?
Well, certainly. I have certainly private views about my fellow writers, but on the other hand, I don't think I have ever, and I've done a certain amount of book reviewing, I don't think I've ever willfully given a negative review to a fellow writer. I'd let the English professors do that. They're the best at that.
Well, you're pretty hard on Lieutenant Calley.
Yeah, but he's hardly a fellow writer. No, I was hard on Calley. I think he was a horrible little excrescence. I was hard on General Douglas MacArthur and a lot of others, but I'm talking about fellow writers. We have enough trouble with the English professors to have to criticize each other.
You mentioned your long-term relationship with Random House. Many of the authors that I speak with complain bitterly about their publishers. Publisher doesn't get behind the book, there's no publicity, but apparently you don't find that to be the case with your publisher.
No, I've had nothing but a very pleasant and completely serene relationship with Random House. It's I was remarking that today with my editor that I don't mean I sat there and drained sentimental tears over the table about it, but I've had a very good relationship with my publisher, and I hope it continues.
Who's your editor at Random House?
Bob Loomis, who went to Duke University with me, has been a friend of mine for most of my adult life.
Do you work with him in the way, say, Maxwell Perkins would work with these other great writers?
Yes, to some extent. I think Maxwell Perkins has got the reputation of over-editing, a man who wrote Thomas Wolfe's books and Scott Fitzgerald's books, or some of the prose therein. But with Bob Loomis, he's a very delicate-handed editor. He's got an uncanny knack of catching me out in my own sloppy mistakes, but he's never once suggested that I radically change anything or tried to alter my own design or to nudge me into some direction where I knew better.
Robert Ludlum and Irving Wallace and Toni Morrison and Roger Strauss, they've all supported the notion of having a trade union for writers. What's your feeling about that?
I'm not terribly interested in any such notion. I wouldn't be against it necessarily, but I don't think I would belong to one myself. I've always felt that writers should be independent spirits, and that I don't feel any onerous burden that society puts on a writer that should cause him to unionize himself. I think we have our own built-in protections, and I would not fight against the idea, but it's just something I wouldn't want to subscribe to.
Just one or two quick questions here, because I've really kept you too long now. But Pete, I noticed you wrote the introduction to the Mitterrand book.
Yeah.
Do you have a relationship with Mitterrand? Do you know him?
Well, it's very yes, I do, and it's very refreshing if you're an American to have a feeling of sympathy with. Well, put it this way, I have a love affair with France, which is long-standing, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, for instance, Sophie's Choice has sold more copies in France as far as Gallimard, my publisher, can determine, than any American novel that's ever been written. It's sold in hardback more than it did here, 200 and some thousand copies. And I have a very harmonious relationship with France. I've lived there a lot, and I like the French. And Mitterrand is a man of, to my mind, of great intellectual dignity and accomplishment. And aside from his socialism, which is another matter, but I certainly am not a non-supporter.
How did you happen to write the introduction?
Well, he invited me to his inaugural, which is an interesting fact in itself. He invited seven writers from the rest of the world. He invited no French writers for a very good reason. He didn't want to cause any dissension. But he did invite myself, Arthur Miller, Elie Wiesel, Julio Cortazar of Argentina, and Garcia Marquez, who just won the Nobel Prize. And we went to the inaugural as his guests because he liked our work. And this is interesting. Not a word about this ever appeared in the American press, which is an indication of how important such a thing is to the American press. But at that point, I met Mitterrand. I don't mean to say that I saw a lot of him during those hurried days, but his publisher here in the United States asked me to write the introduction, which I did. And I think he's taken this as a kind of he's taken me as the American messenger for his message. He's a wonderful writer. He writes beautiful French, and he's a man of great sensitivity and great intelligence. And so it's hard not to be beguiled by a man like that, especially in when we live in the shadow of someone like Ronald Reagan.
Well, one last question. You, at the outset of the interview, you mentioned that the Sophie's Choice was going to premiere as a benefit for Amnesty International. Do you have a relationship with Amnesty International?
I have no connection, but my wife has been a member of the American board for many years, for almost a decade. And it's she who is in connection, I might add, with Alan Pakula, the director of the movie, who is also on the advisory board of Amnesty International here in the United States. Together, it was their idea. I naturally went along with it because I think it's a very, very worthy organization.
To conclude, I wonder if your voice holds out. If you could,
right.
I might be able to integrate this as an open and close of the interview. If you could read the first paragraph or two of Sophie's Choice.
Sure.
If this is agreeable with you.
Absolutely, yes. You just want me to read this? Okay, here we go. In those days, cheap apartments were almost impossible to find in Manhattan, so I had to move to Brooklyn. This was in 1947, and one of the pleasant features of that summer, which I so vividly remember, was the weather, which was sunny and mild, flower fragrant, almost as if the days had been arrested in a seemingly perpetual springtime. I was grateful for that, if for nothing else, since my youth, I felt, was at its lowest ebb. At 22, struggling to become some kind of writer, I found that the creative heat, which at 18 had nearly consumed me with its gorgeous, relentless flame, had flickered out to a dim pilot light, registering little more than a token glow in my breast, or wherever my hungriest aspirations once resided. It was not that I no longer wanted to write. I still yearned passionately to produce the novel which had been for so long captive in my brain. It was only that, having written down the first few fine paragraphs, I could not produce any others, or, to approximate Gertrude Stein's remark about a lesser writer of the lost generation, I had the syrup, but it wouldn't pour. To make matters worse, I was out of a job and had very little money and was self-exiled to Flatbush, like others of my countrymen, another lean and lonesome young Southerner wandering amid the kingdom of the Jews.
Very nice.
Might add that a friend of mine who, alas, is gone to his reward, Romain Gary, when he first, I gave him a copy of this book, and he said, "How did your editor let you get by with that second sentence with two witches in it?" And indeed, it does have two witches. It was too late to correct.